Welcome to the Security Weekly News wrap-up show for the week of 28 November 2021. We got Ben Dorsey, Engine Rat, AT&T, Decryption, IoT, and bad Wi-Fi routers, along with other stories. All this on the Security Weekly News wrap-up.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda.
All right, I'm Doug White, and this is the Security Weekly News wrap-up show. It's episode 172. On Application Security Weekly number 176, John and Mike had Chris Wasopel, the co-founder, CTO, and CISO at Veracode, many hats. Chris was on talking about how developers and security teams can work together. And I mean, this is a sort of perennial, long-term discussion that's been going on pretty much forever. But it's certainly poignant now. And they also talked about like processes that you can use to help deal with this whole security versus development speed. And I've sat on both sides of that table. So, you know, there's always the security side saying this is going to be a problem, and the developers saying, yeah, but we got to get this out the door by Friday. That was, you know, that's the milestone chart deadline. And everybody struggles with that, so as part of DevOps. They also talked about how to improve the maturity of your DevOps teams and some suggestions for doing that. In the second segment, bug bounty payout practices, Edge goes super-duper secure mode, WebKit CSP flaw has consequences for OAuth, GoDaddy breach, vulnerability in MediaTek, audio DSP, and other news. On Business Security Weekly number 242, Ben, Matt, and Tyler talked about CISO leadership, communication skills, and transition. So this was just basically a host discussion. It was about the CISO's transition from a CISO's perspective. So this was all of them sort of interviewing each other about these topics. So it was a nice chance to get some, you know, actual insight from the hosts about their experiences in the CISO realm. In the second segment, a CISO does what? 5 tips to be an awesome CISO, 9 tips for an effective ransomware negotiation, and other news. On Enterprise Security Weekly 252, Adrian, Katie, and Tyler had Edna Conway, the VP, Chief Security and Risk Officer of Azure at Microsoft. Edna was going to talk about defenders sharing information, which is now, you know, a big deal. Is that organized crime and so forth? Supply chain challenges, ransomware trends, and future predictions for all these things. Edna's a really interesting guest if you don't know her. And she started as a lawyer for many years and is now, you know, running this whole thing at Azure. So it's pretty cool. In the second segment, the host talked about the passwordless trend. So this is obviously a new buzzword. And how this new term is, of course, confusing and often misused alongside of dozens of vendors who are all promising to kill the password. That's, of course, the AI-enabled next-gen buzzword of the day. This is a new segment on the show, and it's called First Look. So they're actually going to try and define passwordless and then look at some demos of how these different vendors claim to do passwordless. On Security and Compliance Weekly number 97, Flea Jeff, Johanna Baum, and Kat Valentine had John Threat. Very cool segment. He's a hacker at Media Threat and a kind of a legendary type person. Really a fun episode talking to real hackers, especially OG hackers, about what used to go on. They definitely talked about evolution in hacking and current trends. Really fun. If you missed it, you might want to go back and watch that one. On Security Weekly News number 171, Jason talked about Lloyd's of London deciding to not cover retaliatory cyber operations when nation states or Aaron Leyland are involved in cyber claims. It's a big deal for insurers, and it's a big deal overall about as cyber insurance policies start to sort of mature and become a thing, how will they finally sort of settle? Like, what will be the limitations on cyber insurance? Because everybody wants it, nobody really wants to provide it, and everybody's scared of it because we don't have a lot of data. You know, you start talking about car accidents or whatever, you've got years and years and years of data. Cyber claims, much more challenging to put together policies. On Policy Security Weekly number 720, I finally started getting caught up after moving and was able to get back on the show and even brought my COBOL book, which couldn't compete with COBOL, with Tyler's COBOL book that he put up on the screen later. First up was Selish Atalia. Atalite. I had it down before. Selish is the senior vice president of product management at Qualys. Was on talking about key security challenges that customers face this year. And it was a really, it was a nice, fun segment to talk with somebody who deals with customers directly all the time and get their opinion about where that goes. A lot of fun. And Selish introduced a new hacking movie in the five questions part of that segment. A new hacking movie I don't think any of us had talked about before, which is Firewall. I think everybody had seen it, but nobody had actually thought about it again. And he put that down as his favorite hacking movie. So it was kind of an interesting new introduction to the five question part of the segment. On the second segment, the news included a debate about The Matrix being the best hacking movie ever among all the other news. And in the third segment, a pre-record with Sven Morgenroth. And if you don't know, Sven is a security researcher at NetSparker. Always a lot of fun to have on the show. But Sven presented some common vulnerabilities and issues with authentication and authorization in web application. And every time Sven comes on to present these things, I'm always like, okay, this is going to be interesting. Just a news note, Security Weekly Unlocked will be now a one-day virtual event on the 16th of December. If you bought tickets already, I think you can get refunds if you request them. They do have free passes, so if you're interested in participating in and seeing all the talks at Unlocked, they will be on the 16th of December, and I think it's free now. Next week, there are no shows, so we'll miss you, but the crew deserves a week off, so we will not be here next week. My thread of the week is going to be this story about encryption and decryption. This story was on Policy Security Weekly, and we had a pretty long talk about this on the show. So if you want to go back and watch that, it's definitely worth your time, I think. This is an article from Jeff Koslow at ExtraHop. And the basic focus of this article was that that pretty much everything now is encrypted on the network, and it's gotten to be impossible to tell the good from the bad because you can't see what it actually is. And so was advocating four myths about decryption and that we should be able to decrypt network traffic since, you know, it's all encrypted. The article goes on and talks about a lot of lateral movement and malware is encrypted, your command and control exchanges and so forth. So you really can't see what's being done with all this encrypted traffic. Now, my initial take on this and on the show was to agree with it. I was sort of looking at it from a perspective of I'm a network administrator. It's my border. I'm running the network, so I ought to be able to decrypt inbound and outbound traffic in order for me to see what's coming and going in my realm that I'm responsible for. And I still kind of hold this position. I felt a bit lonely on Pulse Security Weekly. Because I think I was the only person that even was willing to consider this idea. But my idea and just the way I took it was that I have a network policy, and that policy says you shouldn't be doing certain things on my network, and I ought to be able to observe what you're doing. And that, to me, was not out of line with my point of view. It's an enterprise network. I control it. If you're doing stuff that's your personal business, you shouldn't be doing it on my enterprise network. And most places have policies very in line with that. So if you want to go gambling or watching porn or whatever it is you want to do at work, I ought to be able to know that you're doing that and come and tell you you shouldn't be doing that, because I've seen all those things being done on corporate networks. We've tracked people down and had discussions with them about you can't be gambling at work, you can't be watching porn at work, you can't be downloading whatever you're downloading. And all those things happen in the real world. And so, you know, but nobody else would go along with me on this. So on the show, I basically got shot to pieces when I sort of expressed that. Tyler felt like, you know, and I think Joff too, that their attacks were going to be double wrapped. They were going to be so complex and so hidden and encrypted that I would never, ever be able to decrypt them and figure out what was going on. Jeff was worried about the government snooping. Paul didn't like any of it and sort of preferred behavioral to detection to decryption of traffic. And I was kind of left alone saying, well, this might be okay. I wasn't really committed to it because I definitely know how I felt when the university, this was a long time ago, the university announced that they were going to be basically reviewing email. And plenty of my corporate clients that I've worked for basically tell you they're reading everything you send in and out of the corporate network. And I know they're doing that because I've been written up before because they said you shouldn't have sent this document from here to home, even though I was sending it from myself to myself. They were like, this is a violation. So they were definitely reading my email. And I didn't like it. I mean, I wasn't doing anything I felt was wrong. And you know, anytime I'm doing something I feel like is wrong or that my dad would disapprove of, I feel like maybe I shouldn't be doing this. But I will guarantee you that there's stuff going in and out of your network that you may want to review. So the network isn't really that different from the email, in my opinion. I ought to be able to review what's going on. If you're connecting to some server in North Korea, I wouldn't mind seeing what it is you're doing. Now, Paul's argument there, of course, was if you're connecting to North Korea, that's an anomaly and we ought to stop it in the first place. And I don't disagree with that. I went ahead and assumed I'm never going to catch Tyler and Joff. If they're hacking me, I'm going to get hacked. I mean, those Uber hacker people are going to take me out every time. I don't have a chance of beating those guys. I also don't want to turn all my keys over to the government and law enforcement political review committees, but on my enterprise, if it's internal and I controlled it, I really felt like I wanted to be able to see what you were doing. I don't want to see this connection that's going somewhere and have to try to figure out what you're connecting to and is it legit or not. And then I come call you out and say, why were you connecting to this? I mean, it is my network. It's not the public airways. It's not your home personal use account that I want to review. But, you know, and I'm not going to catch Tyler and Joff. I mean, I'm going to be toast there. But again, that's not my goal. My goal was to try to see that VP of marketing is downloading a whole bunch of porn movies onto the network over a VPN, that somebody in the company was uploading proprietary material to a public site or a competitor or so forth. And I grant you, we can all figure out ways around this. I mean, the immediate response to this is every time is, well, yeah, but I can beat this. I can do this. I can do that. But I really wasn't trying to catch the sophisticates. I was trying to catch Jane Average in the marketing department who decided to upload the entire customer database to a public bucket because they didn't know what they were doing. You know, it's like, oh, I could store this here. And Paul has a really good point that, you know, it was like, okay, well, you know, if somebody's uploading to a public bucket, maybe that's an anomaly and you don't need to see what's in the content to actually make that determination. I mean, if I really get hardcore on the border behavior, I may well want to be able to detect bad behaviors, and I may be able to do that from inside and outside. But again, I just can't go call Jane Average out and say, you connected to an unknown site. I'm going to have to stop you. I guess I could do the Dan's Guardian kind of proxying stuff that we've all done, whether it was with Dan Guardian or some other kind of, you know, appliance to try to prevent all those kind of connections. So I was kind of on board with Paul's position because I think I could manage it from there. But in the end, I think that Jeff really won me over because he was talking about all the times in the past that the NSA and the FBI and the other government entities have wanted to build skeleton keys into something crypto. I know there was talk about, you know, how do we stop blockchain? How do we prevent bitcoins and all this kind of stuff? And, you know, the PGP case was probably the most famous one I could think of, you know, that was the government was saying if they put this PGP in place, we will never be able to watch what people are doing on the internet. And so PGP just released their software into the public domain before the government could try to enforce this, which means it was already out there. So what are you going to do? I mean, so if you want to decrypt all the traffic at the border, and the article didn't say layer 7, but I presume that's kind of what they meant, I mean, well, you'd essentially have to have some kind of backdoor into the traffic, and that now you're right back into this realm that Jeff was talking about, which is this clipper chip stuff where, A, either you do it and basically nobody wants to use the network, or they double encrypt everything because they're going, well, we know that it can be seen, or B, the government subpoenas the keys from you at some point, even though you have them internally, and says you must release all this traffic so we can look at it. And then it starts turning into this Pegasus thing. You know, where maybe we consider the government to be good, but they're only good until they aren't. You know, it's kind of like that good guy with a gun thing. It's like a good guy with a gun until that femtosecond when they suddenly become a bad guy with a gun. You know, and then we have a, we're not going to get into those kind of political discussions, but it's the same idea. And I can really see and appreciate the law enforcement arguments on this stuff, since they want ways to wiretap bad guys and terrorists, and that always gets my support. Until it doesn't, because, you know, who are the bad guys and who are the terrorists? And, well, that can turn into politics, right? I mean, when do law enforcement officers stop being serve and protect people and start being the secret police, or start enforcing political points of view or whatever? And I mean, I always tell myself that can't happen, but I got news for you. It can happen. It's happened over and over throughout history, and suddenly they're good guys turn into bad guys. They're good guys and good government guys, and all of a sudden it's like, oh no, we're not good guys anymore. We're going to enforce our point of view, and we're going to start snooping on everything you're doing. And, you know, somebody's trying to see, did somebody say that dear leader isn't the best and most handsome leader that ever lived, so they can round you up? And all of a sudden, in the end, I didn't really agree with this whole decryption thing. Despite my initial kind of okayness I had on Pulse Security Weekly, you know, And Tyler and Joff are pretty sure they can still move laterally from my printer onto the office pinball machine. Jeff's pretty sure that at some point privacy is going to be violated. And Paul's feeling that behavior is a better indicator of anomaly. Well, the article starts to sound like shaky ground to me. Don't get me wrong. I still think in an academic sense they are right. And as a network engineer, I still would like to be able to see what you're doing. I don't think there's going to be a practical application, though, of decrypting stuff on the fly at the border anytime soon that's going to be able to be protected from all these dangers that seem to come up. The article's definitely worth your read, though. So if you have your own opinion, and you should have your own opinion, you know, read it and decide for yourself. I don't disagree with what was said in the article. I think everything that was said there is kind of true, but I don't wholly agree with it either, especially in practice. And now the news. The first story said that ransomware damage has increased 935%. Now, this was based on a report from Group IB High Tech Crime Trends for 2021-2022. And basically what they're saying is that the ransomware industry is going through the same kind of development that you see in other industry. And that, you know, it's maturing. So ransomware is such a big deal that ransomware companies are now affiliating with corporate access brokers, which is another kind of crime, right? And it's sort of a vertical integration. I mean, you know, they have help desks now in the dark web and on ransomware businesses. So I guess, you know, vertical integration is next. Corporate access brokers are basically people that have backdoors or something already implanted in various networks that they keep hidden, so that when you want to pay them, they can connect you. And a lot of them won't give you the keys. They just simply create you a VPN and tell you to connect to it, and you're inside of some, you know, major organization's network. Yikes. So if the ransomware people need access, maybe they can outsource the access part, because why spend all that time trying to con someone into letting you in when some other organization's already got the access that you need? Do a merger, and all of a sudden you got a massive crime organization. The report anyway says that the number of initial access brokers went from 85 to 229 during the reporting period, and the offers to sell access tripled from 362 to 1099. I don't know exactly how they got all this data, but what does this all tell us anyway? Well, double ransomware means that even if you have effective backups, unless you want your sensitive corporate material leaked on the internet, well, you still have to pay. And two, you may already be compromised. So if you're already compromised and somebody's making a deal to sell access to your network right now, which means that despite all the training you spent on your users to try to keep them from clicking bad links and so forth, and, you know, there's somebody still got bait that's working and they've got access to the network. and other flaws may exist that you don't even know about, like vulnerabilities and so forth. So those access brokers are going to get into your network. So this is a kind of scary development. And I mean, I think this industry is going to continue to grow until we find better ways of preventing it. AT&T has been dealing with, speaking of compromised networks, AT&T has been dealing with a botnet in their network of VOIP servers. So those voice over internet protocol. The botnet that they're dealing with is called Eudor, and it was running on 5,700 VOIP servers. So that's a lot of space. The botnet was attacking the Edgewater network devices that they were using, and they had a known vulnerability that was released in a report earlier this week. This is Edgemark appliance, and it had a flaw. And here we are with these web servers again, had a flaw in a hidden page on the web server that would allow someone to use that page as a shell to execute commands. So that's probably left over from when they were developing this thing, because you see that kind of stuff. That's been going on since the mainframe days. There's some secret back door or whatever. In fact, you know, that's where that term maintenance hook kind of comes from. AT&T said that they were managing the botnet, which most likely was destined to be used as a distributed denial of service from VOIP devices, but they said that it didn't appear to have been weaponized yet and that it did not appear any data had been compromised. The article does say that a finding due to the botnet was that about 100,000 IP addresses were using the same SSL certificate. So this is called wildcard SSL certs, and we've all been, you know, you've heard us talk about this. You've probably talked about it before. And people do this all the time, because when you have to try to generate 100,000 separate certs for all these devices, that gets to be a bit unwieldy. So they do wildcards. But if you do this, it basically creates a shortcut that allows what's called an alpaca attack. And an alpaca attack is an app layer protocol attack where they cross the protocol. We've done quite a few stories on alpaca attacks ever since those were revealed earlier this year. There have been several reports this year of similar attacks like this. So if AT&T has hundreds of thousands of devices that are using wildcard certs, and someone's figured out how to exploit this and operate botnets on their VOIP backbone, well, that would be bad, okay? I mean, it's already a problem where they are right now, but if this is how they have it set up, it won't be very long before they're reinfected, even if they've got it under control, because they're just going to come right back in using the same tactics. So AT&T may have a much bigger problem than it initially appeared. 9 different Wi-Fi routers were analyzed, and 226 potential vulnerabilities were found, even though they were running the latest firmware. So these weren't old devices. These were pretty new ones. The devices from Asus, D-Link, Netgear, Edimax, TP-Link, Synology, and Linksys represented a large portion of that SOHO market for Wi-Fi routers. I mean, you probably have one of those brands at home or in your small business if you have a Wi-Fi router. The TP-Link Archer AX6000 won the contest for the most flaws, with 32 known flaws. And the Synology RT2600 AC had 30. The more common problems were outdated Linux kernels, outdated VPN, outdated multimedia, old versions of BusyBox, weak default password, and hard-coded credentials. Apparently, the manufacturers saw the report that came out, and they released firmware updates pretty quickly for these devices. But the issue remains that many, many, many of these SOHO-type devices and end-user devices are sold to people who don't have very much knowledge, they don't have any training, they don't have any support staff to guide them through updating, especially updating firmware. And I have seen, even in businesses, like even in some not tiny businesses, they were using SOHO routers just straight out of the box. They went to Best Buy and they bought a Linksys router and they plugged it in, and that was it. That was all they did. And you know, firmware updates are not something that everybody is able to do or willing to do. And you know, maybe, or we'll do that next week when we get a chance. And you know, and the next thing you know, you're 19 versions behind. And remember, some of these smaller entities may be connecting to larger networks too. So this is not just a, oh well, nobody's going to bother Farmer Joe's egg farm, because you know, it's a farm, but it is a farm that delivers to the airbase, and they're connected, and yeah, that kind of attack. So it is a big deal. Engine Rat is a piece of malware that runs on e-commerce Nginx servers and is being used to steal payment card data. from all these online stores that are on these devices. The malware itself injects Nginx processes that look exactly like legitimate Nginx processes, which means it's really hard to spot this when you're looking at the PS screen. SANSEC researchers said that the malware is delivered by cron rat, which is very similar to this Nginx rat, engine rat. And the Trojans both focus on allowing modifications to server-side code, which allows you basically to record post request data on the server. So that's after it gets decrypted, right? So it comes in, it may be, you know, heavy encrypted coming in, but once it gets to the server, it's decrypted. So these rats are basically ways to try to extract this information as it comes into the web server. There is an example in the story showing how the process looked on the PS screen. So if you want to see what it looks like, but I mean, honestly, I don't know how on earth you delineate between those various processes. Cronrat can be used to embed all sorts of jobs in your cron. So if you find evidence of cronrat infections or this engine rat infection, well, basically the researchers said it's very likely there's all kinds of other malware already embedded in your system as well. There's a full analysis of the malware in the article. So if you're interested in it or you use these types of servers, you know, you may want to check it out. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, as it's known in the United States, is issuing new directives and recommendations targeting the cybersecurity operations at U.S. rail and airports. Probably this is after all those Alt 2600 pictures you always see of, you know, stuff at the airport and the train station with Windows XP blue screens up there. And you're going, wow, they're still using that, huh? It's definitely part of an increasing infrastructure focus on cybersecurity in the United States due to recent supply chain and other critical infrastructure attacks. The new directives will require passenger and freight rail operators to identify a cybersecurity point person, which will, of course, be the person that's got, you know, that nobody wants that job. They've got to report incidents within 24 hours to CISA, conduct vulnerability assessment, and develop contingency and recovery plans. All of this is going to go into effect at the end of this year. Of course, you know, one of the risks of these kind of mandates is if you mandate things without a budget, it does tend to be pretty ineffective since they end up trying to get the local Cub Scout troop to try and run their pen test, or they call me and they go, I bet some of your students would love to come over and install some anti-malware stuff for us. Hopefully, though, they will mandate some budget to be put into this as well. The UK government is trying to set some basic minimum standards for IoT devices, which would include the elimination of default passwords, passwordless, required vulnerability disclosures, and update commitments for IoT. The proposed legislation, which has not been passed yet, got a lot of criticism for being too little too late, but at the same time, it does seem to be trying to sort of gently force the IoT market in the right direction without overwhelming the market itself with, you know, rules that might increase the prices of IoT devices and or create situations where you couldn't even get IoT devices, you know, with supply chain problems and so forth, because people would be shipping things. I don't know where this legislation ends up. There's not a lot of laws on the books currently trying to control IoT and IIoT devices, and those things are filled with vulnerabilities and other issues that make them extremely subject to compromise, and people are putting them up all over the place. But, you know, everybody loves their gadgets. You're seeing them from people's homes all the way up through manufacturing environments and so forth, and there's no sign that's going to go away anytime soon. So if there is more disclosure about what flaws are there, I guess the idea here is that maybe the market will force manufacturers to do a better job of testing this stuff, but it hasn't passed yet. And I'm sure there's plenty of lobbyists out there banging their drums about how, you know, this is going to be a problem. But I would not be shocked to see that there's more of these laws on the way soon. And finally, I don't know what the deal is with changing names. There was a time when it was unthinkable to change the name of a successful brand. I mean, that's why Pepsi didn't change their name to Slurm or something back, you know, 30 years ago. But with the big techs, it's all about name changes lately. I don't really get it, and it's so confusing. I mean, I remember when Google changed the name to Alphabet, and I was like, what? But Google didn't change, and we still call it Google, and everybody still says Google, and nobody says Alphabet, but it is actually called Alphabet, and Google is a product under the Alphabet umbrella. How about when Facebook just recently changed their name to Meta? I mean, you still have Facebook and you still have Instagram and all and Snapchat and all these things, but, you know, now it's called Meta. And, you know, maybe that's just a sign the company got bigger. Well, the story is about that Square is now jumping on the bandwagon and changing its name to Block. Okay, I guess that's a 3D square. I don't know. Some people suggested it was about blockchain, about all kinds of stuff. Maybe they'll change it to Tesseract. Anyway, they aren't changing any of their products and their product name, so I guess Block will just be like Alphabet and just be a sort of Meta kind of name of the company. And that's a news wrap-up for the week of 28 November 2021. There are no shows next week. Lonely face, lonely face. We'll see you later. Bye.